When the common person hears talk of Mardi Gras, beads, drinking, Bourbon Street, and even Hurricane Katrina, they think of New Orleans. But there is a special group of people who see it through a completely different lens, the locals. Their roots run deep within the city. Also, historians, paranormal investigators, and those who simply choose to see beyond what one's mind can fathom think of something completely different. They don't just see it, they feel it in their bones. The rich and dark history of the city is draped in the macabre. From hauntings to voodoo, vampires to witch doctors, and from the early Creole days to present, New Orleans is arguably the paranormal focal point of the South. In today's episode, we'll dive into the eerie history of the Ursuline Convent of Charles Street in the French Quarter, and the mysterious women who inhabited it and closely guarded its upper levels. While we'd love to dive into all the mystery and lore of New Orleans, this episode is going to dive specifically into one of the many stories of vampirism in the Big Easy.
You're listening to Creepy Unsolved with Dylan and Sabrina.
So on today's episode, we're going to be talking about a local legend, one that, unless you were from New Orleans or the surrounding areas, you might have never heard of. But before we dive into this, we have a couple things to talk about. So first off, we have a new comment on Instagram from a user named Megan_3XC. And she left a really nice comment for us, so I just wanted to share it on here and give her a shout out. So thank you for this, Megan. She said, "I came across your podcast on iHeartRadio app. I've been hooked ever since. I just can't get enough of it. Thanks for being great at what you're doing and exposing myself and other listeners alike to all the amazing guests you have on." So definitely thank you for that. And I feel like all of our previous guests are just as grateful as we are for this comment. Thank you, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much, Megan. That, I don't know, it just like really warms my heart when people are hooked on this podcast as much as me and Dylan get, you know, hooked on studying the paranormal and studying other paranormal podcasts. So yeah, thank you so much for your support.
And another thing, it is Sabrina's birthday today at the time of this recording. So happy birthday, Sabrina.
Thank you. Honestly, this has been what I've been looking forward to all week. People have been asking me like, what are you going to do for your birthday? And I'm like, I'm going to podcast and talk about some cool, creepy shit. So yeah, this is really the highlight of my week. And like, I think doing this podcast has been the highlight of my year. So I guess thank you, Dylan, for making this possible and giving me such a fantastic thing to be a part of. But also thank you so much to our listeners. Like, you guys having interest in this podcast and supporting us and our passion for telling stories of things that are beyond the day-to-day news cycle, it really, really means the world to us. So thank you, guys. Thank you, Dylan. Yeah, happy birthday to me. I'm 27, so I'm not going to say that again for the rest of ever. We're done with birthdays now. I just want y'all to know that I'm done having birthdays. Like, it's over. But it is my birth week and I'm a Leo, so also I'll be deeply offended if you don't listen to this episode. So yeah, thanks.
Alrighty. You ready to jump into this one?
I am so ready.
All right. Take us to Louisiana.
Okay. So flashback to the late 1600s, Louisiana, to include the major port city of New Orleans, was under French rule from early 1680 until around 1800. Problems quickly arose with early French settlers because they were mostly men. like an alarming amount men. Like pretty much it was just a sausage fest in the deep south. And like, I can only imagine how weird that shit got. So, yeah, King Louis XIV trying to settle the territory and establish a steady population, which, fun fact, you cannot do with just men in the area. Thought of a fast but cringily inhumane solution. His fucking idea was to take women, aka girls barely into puberty, from France and put them somewhere else. New Orleans. So, cue the Ursuline convent. And if any of our listeners were raised Catholic and the word convent, like, immediately strikes a nerve with you, like, I promise this story is going to get even more on that level. So, yeah. This convent was a quote-unquote sanctuary, yes, emphasis on the air quotes, for girls sent from France with the sole purpose of helping populate the colony. Major Handmaid's Tale vibes.
So hold up real quick. What is the Handmaid's Tale? Because I've seen it, like the previews obviously for it, but I've never watched it.
It was a book written by Margaret Atwood, pretty sure, 90% sure, that was talking about this like weird dystopian future society where like certain women were designated to be like birthers.
Oh, okay.
And were forced to carry the children and be inseminated by like the elites of the nation. And then there's like a revolt and blah, blah, blah.
So it's kind of like The Giver. Isn't that how The Giver played out too?
It is, but it's like a lot less consensual.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's gross. It's icky. It's very icky.
But anyways...
So on top of being sent on this terrible mission, these girls would unknowingly be sent into the arms of vagrants and thieves and usually were never heard from by their families again. Allegedly, the King of France handpicked these girls as part of the colony's assistance plan. That's a really great term for it. It's an assistance plan, guys. Don't worry. And these girls were like the poorest of the poor in France. Their parents were promised that, like, they'd have a good life and they'd, you know, be in the new world with respectable husbands and a place to call home, like the, you know, 1600s American dream for a woman. But this clearly was not the case. I just am gonna marry a nice rich man and start a family and have all his babies and blah, blah. No, that wasn't it. Sorry, honey, but no. Each different girl was sent to New Orleans with luggage boxes, and they came in all different sizes for the bare minimum of what could be considered accommodations. So, like, obviously they were poor in the 1600s. They didn't have much stuff. But the ones, like, the luggage containers that stuck out were these small, eerie, coffin-shaped containers that eventually coined the young women the name the Casket Girls. And presumably, these caskets held their belongings, but no one knows for sure what the girls brought with them on their journey. It's unknown how many girls were shipped on the 6-month voyage across the Atlantic. All that is certain is that after they arrived, the mortality rate skyrocketed. But to be more precise, the infant mortality rate was highly affected. And to put that in layman's terms, that means there was a lot of deaths. Specifically, there was a lot of baby deaths. As the girls set foot on the hot Louisiana land, the Frenchmen who came to gawk at them, these dudes immediately started gossiping, right, about how pale the girls were. They were so pale that it said that their skin reddened and blistered within moments of enduring the hot subtropical sun. And just side note, like, if you're stuck on a ship for 6 months, it's not like you're going to be getting a fucking tan, dudes. So, first of all, mind your business. But yeah, so, these poor girls clutching their casket-shaped chests in tight grips were brought to their new home. until their respective marriages, they were to remain under the care and the protection of the Ursuline nuns. The girls lived in humble and like humble, humble accommodations on the third floor until their quote unquote weddings. And by the third floor, I mean the third floor of the Ursuline convent. A convent, for those who don't know, is a place where nuns live. It's just where they put nuns. If you ever wondered where they put nuns, that's where they go.
The third floor is like the attic of this place, correct?
Yeah. It's like the top story because, I mean, I don't know if you've been to the South, but like there's not a lot of three-story buildings. And
no,
so,
heat rises.
Yeah. One can only imagine how fucking awful that would be. Plus living with a bunch of nuns.
It has to be ungodly hot up there. And I'm sure if they had beds, they were cramped together in the small living quarters within the attic.
Yeah. It's like rows of bunks with unbearable heat. And based off one article that I saw of an investigator that went into the Ursuline convent like recently, like in the last couple decades, it was just no drywall on the walls, just like bare siding. So it was dark. There weren't a lot of windows. Like, ugh.
Yuck.
No, thank you. But I mean, depending on how poor they were, that could have been an upgrade from whatever they were living in. I don't know. But anyway, on a more serious note, here is where the story turns tragic. The fate of the Casket Girls was not as expected by the French king. But I don't know why he expected everything to work well is also a mystery. I mean, I guess it's because he's a king and he's just like, oh, yes, you know, everything goes well in people's lives because I, the king, said it would. Like, I don't fucking know, dude. But yeah, the local men gravely disrespected the women. Some of the girls were placed into unwanted marriages only to be mistreated by their husbands. And then others, upon finding themselves alone and unwed, were forced into prostitution. And thinking about the ages of these girls, like, they were just in a puberty, like, they weren't adults. Like, that's so fucking sad. Like, it really breaks my heart to think about it. Being alone, thousands of miles from home, at the whim of some random fucking men, to only be treated like garbage, like an object. When we think about the heaviness that hangs over certain places like old prisons, asylums, hospitals, and battlefields, etc., you know, it's believed that because of the tragedy that happened to the people there, that this heaviness exists, like this atmosphere of just something terrible happened here. And the same can be said for the Ursuline convent. Everyone that's investigated there has reported that there's this heaviness that just looms over it. And one can only assume it's echoing back to what happened to these essentially children who were human trafficked as child brides and then suffered a fate even worse. But that is not where our tale of the Casket Girls of the Ursuline convent ends. So when the French king caught wind of how the girls that he sent to help the new colonies were being treated, he ordered their immediate return. So the nuns of the Ursuline convent grabbed the girls' caskets, aka grabbed their shit, and climbed the steps to the third floor, ready to tell these girls to get the fuck out. Now, I would like to highlight that the windows to the third floor had always been sealed shut. And it's important for what happens next. One would think initially that they were probably sealed shut to keep these fucking weirdo dudes that haven't seen a woman in like X amount of years from staring at them. But I don't know. Who knows? When the nuns opened the doors to the girls' quarters, they were empty. Like, there wasn't a soul to be seen. Not one. They searched every section of the third floor for the girls. And it was then that they searched their caskets and found them also to be completely empty. They also searched for the contents of their belongings, which they had assumed were in their caskets, but they were never recovered. Like, the girls were gone, their shit was gone, but they left the containers in which they brought their shit to begin with. So that's weird. Like, if I were to run away, I would pack a bag.
You'd take something with you. Yeah.
Yeah. If I didn't have a bag, I would use the bag that I had brought my stuff in to begin with. The logical, like, A to B to C process. But, like, this isn't what happened. Their stuff was gone. They were gone, but their bags were still there. So where did they go? This immediately struck fear into the nuns. Like, how could these girls have disappeared without a trace? Rationally, clearly sarcastic, fearing that the young women might have been entities of the devil, the Ursuline nuns spared no expense in making sure that nothing ever left that third floor space. Like, it was a full-blown satanic panic shit show. The doors and the windows to the third floor were sealed shut with 800 nails blessed by the Pope himself. Now, why they had these nails lying around, I have no idea. But now I feel like I want some blessed nails to keep demonic entities and bullshit out of my house too. I feel like there's a market for that. We should sell that with our merch.
That'd be cool.
Blessed nails. That would be fucking cool. So yeah, the rumor mill obviously started spinning. The whispers about these pale, skinny girls who arrived off a ship from a foreign land now evolved to calling them vampires.
Wow. That really makes you wonder where they went.
Where the fuck did they go? Like, it's New Orleans. No one just fucking wanders off into the woods. There's snakes out there.
But not even the woods. I think they have, it's more swampland too, ain't it?
Yeah, there's fucking alligators. There's snakes. There's large bugs.
So while we're on the topic of vampirism in New Orleans, there is another popular figure throughout New Orleans history and European history alike, spanning over multiple years. And in multiple, I mean hundreds. So there is a man by the name of Le Comte de Saint-Germain, who is popularly believed to be a vampire. So another notable story throughout New Orleans history featuring an individual who quite possibly have been a vampire is that of the story of Le Comte de Saint-Germain. So Saint-Germain was a very interesting and mysterious figure throughout history. And I mean throughout history. First making his appearance as a member of the court of France's Louis XV, being or claiming to be an alchemist by trade. And he commonly and openly spoke of being over 6,000 years old. Like, this dude already sounds like a lunatic. Like, I don't know how he's hanging out with all these high court people. But anyways,
I don't know how he's not hanging out off the branch of a tree.
Exactly. So at other times, his stories would conflict and he would claim to be the son of Francis II Rakowski, who was the Prince of Transylvania, born in 1702. So conveniently enough, Transylvania is wrapped up into this mix. So because of his high standing position in society, he'd be seen at countless balls and dinner parties, but it is noted by all who attended that Saint-Germain never ate. He would simply sit back and sip red wine and tell stories all throughout history. And it was noted that he was very knowledgeable about multiple different historic events spanning all across, you know, Europe and the surrounding areas. So following his time spent in France, around 1748, he had moved to Germany. And years later, he would reportedly die. Even following his reported death, He would continue to be seen and spotted throughout Europe and eventually in New Orleans. So flash forward, remember this started in 1702 when he was born. By 1903, a young charismatic Frenchman by the name of Jacques Saint-Germain would arrive in New Orleans. He would reside in a home at the corner of Royale and Ursuline Streets, and he was reportedly he's reported as being popular among many women, and they would take interest in this dashing, charismatic fellow. And it is said that Saint-Germain would be spotted with a different woman on his arm every evening on the streets of the French Quarter. But abruptly, his nightly excursions would come to an end on one December evening when a woman's ear-piercing screams were heard coming from within Saint-Germain's quarters. Quickly following this, a woman would plunge into the streets, throwing herself from a second-story window, landing hard on the street below, and bystanders would rush up to her side, and she would cry out that Saint-Germain had bit her. In an attempt to escape, she had thrown herself out of this window. This woman would later die, or later in the evening would die at Charity Hospital, and by the time police made it to Jacques Saint-Germain's home, he had vanished seemingly into thin air. But they'd still go into his home, and the sight of what they saw next would, absolutely shock the police for years to come. Not only were there large blood stains soaked into the hardwood floor, but countless wine bottles were found filled with human blood scattered throughout his home. Following this, Saint-Germain was never seen again, and his home was declared as a crime scene and sealed off. But from this night to present day, no one has lived in this home. But despite all this, the property and all of its taxes had been paid to date.
By who?
By Saint-Germain.
What the fuck? Why is a vampire paying taxes? First of all, that brings up a whole bunch of questions like, is the government vampires?
Ooh, those bloodsuckers.
I mean, it's kind of true. Taxes are blood in a way. I just killed another fruit fly. But what the fuck?
That is wild to wrap your head around.
No, it really is.
And I encourage everyone who is listening to, kind of dive deeper into the story. It gets pretty interesting. This is just scraping the surface.
No, it really is. I found so many articles on Saint-Germain. We could do an entire episode. Ooh, and comment if you would like us to do an episode on Saint-Germain. But shameless plug, yep. But yeah, so the tradition of vampires in New Orleans still thrives to this day. Not necessarily people with supernatural abilities, while we can't rule that out. But it's not all that difficult to find people in NOLA with teeth filed into fangs who actually drink human blood. There's even a New Orleans Vampire Association, which does community service to help the city's homeless, which is pretty dope. You live your life, you do your fucking blood drinking shit, you help the city's homeless, good for you. New Orleans also has a really heavy feature of vampirism in their pop culture. So New Orleans itself helped inspire author Anne Rice to write a book in 1976 named Interview with a Vampire. And then in 1994, a film adaptation would introduce the same title, starring Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise. And if you love 90s goth films like I do, that movie will immediately, just the mention of the name of it, bring memories and visions of what vampirism in New Orleans may or may not look like. Also, from 2008 to 2014, HBO would feature a show named True Blood, which I know a million and a half people have watched.
Oh, definitely.
But yeah, it took vampirism to a whole new level. This show was set in fictional Bontem, Louisiana, showing what it might be like having vampires adjust to life living among, well, the living.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've watched that show, but I watched quite a few seasons of that, and they expand beyond just vampires into different types of lore. Like, there are, you know, werewolves in it, obviously, because you can't have a vampire film without werewolves or any show of the topic. But it goes into, you know, the fae and fairies. There's segments of that. And
I have a question.
Yep.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but like, would you be a vampire or a werewolf?
Oh, God.
And why?
I would rather be a shapeshifter, honestly.
That is not the question. That was not one of the options. A or B?
I'd probably be a vampire because I want to live forever, honestly.
Damn. I would be a werewolf because then me and my dogs could, you know, fucking start a pack, even though we are a pack, do dog stuff, do people stuff. Like, I turn my dogs into werewolves. They turn into people. That's, in my mind, how
now,
that works.
Now, what kind of werewolf are you envisioning, though? Are you, like, standing on two legs, like, running around, that kind of werewolf? Or are you, like, shape-shifting into an actual wolf?
I'm imagining the Twilight version of a werewolf where you're like a super attractive human in real life. And then when you turn into a werewolf, you're just like a fucking dire wolf.
Yeah. Okay. That's a different story then. Like, I'm already hairy enough. Like, I could probably pull that off.
Oh my God. That's amazing. So we're just going to be on opposite sides of the fence here. Well, and the podcast is going to turn into vampire versus werewolf.
Well, I'm thinking of Underworld too. You ever watch that?
I'd be an Underworld werewolf.
All right. So let's talk about some recent lore.
So yeah, this one really was like, what the fuck to me. In 1978, that is not the year I was born. For everyone that just, you know, heard that it's my birthday and stuck around this far. I was not born in 1978, so fuck all y'all. But in 1978, two paranormal investigators seeking answers to whether the Casket Girls had in fact been vampires camped out directly in front of the Ursuline Convent. They'd been previously kicked off the property for loitering, but decided to stay the night out in front and see if they experienced anything directly outside the walls themselves. So they waited minute by minute for something to happen. But like every good piece of shit, like me, they fell asleep. And while they slept, they failed to notice the third floor's shutters, the same ones which had been locked shut by the 800 blessed nails, open and shut, open and shut. The recording cameras they had set up had whirred to a stop, and the scene faded to black. But, you know, the next morning, the bodies of the investigators were found. The bodies had been torn open, ravaged, as if by the claws of an animal, and their bodies were completely drained of blood. And not like there was a giant fucking pool of blood on the sidewalk for all you smartasses out there. Like, there was no blood. No blood in the bodies, no blood outside of the bodies. Just, it was gone. It was gone. There was no blood. The end.
Were the shutters still flapping?
I don't know.
Oh, that's great.
Draw your own conclusions.
That is wild to think about.
Yeah, what the fuck? That's some like Paranormal Activity shit. Like, they're just flapping and then they're gone and then all of a sudden there's bodies.
I'm thinking of the what's in the box meme. You know that meme? It's like, what's in the box? But the, where's the blood? That's fucking lame.
I'm sorry, but like, I know you're a dad, but that was a very dad reference. And I appreciate you as a human.
Oh, man. So I think that is about it for this one.
No, no, no.
No, is there more?
Wild speculation time, Dylan.
Oh, yeah. We can't forget about that.
Do we think they were vampires or not?
Man, I feel like I do this a lot. And with every every story we tell and every time it comes to this to ask if it's true or not, I'm a sucker. And I'm like, no, this is obviously true based off all this shit we just read. Like, I'm pretty gullible, but I think the stories surrounding it are good, but I'm not convinced that there are actual vampires living in there. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, so here's the thing. Like, we don't know definitively whether or not they were. Like, they just up and disappeared. But in my mind, I genuinely hope that these girls wreaked havoc on the motherfuckers that treated them like garbage, on the nuns that locked them in an attic. Like, even if they weren't vampires, I hope that they created some, like, ruse that they were vampires and that they were just tormenting the fucking city. Because they're like, fuck you. You took us from our families. You brought us all the way across the ocean. We can't get back. So, I mean, also, like, what if the nuns took their stuff? Like,
you just threw it out.
These bitches, no. They didn't have like a mirror or a hairbrush in my mind, I'm assuming, because I imagine nuns as like these very mean old ladies. What if they just took their shit and they're like, oh no, what happened? It was just gone. They were gone. The stuff was gone. Must have been the devil. And like, so these nuns took their shit, locked them in an attic. They finally broke out and the nuns are like, must have been the devil. And these girls are like, bitch, you took the only shit I had. I'm going to ruin your life and make you think we're vampires.
I love it.
And that's what I think happened. I think it was a petty revenge story. And they like maybe moved out into the woods and created like this cool, you know, swamp fortress. And lived happily ever after. And in my mind, that's just where it's going to be. That's where it's going to end.
And like, why not? Everybody else was doing it at the time.
Yeah. They're settling their own land.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up. So, you know, before we go, if you're planning on starting a podcast, be sure to check out buzzsprout.com. And if you sign up today using the link found in the show notes, you will receive a $20 Amazon gift card after signing up for a paid plan. So that doesn't only help you, but it helps our show grow as well. And what else do we have for them? We have a conspiracy theory trivia pursuit board game. So tell us about that, Sabrina.
Okay, so this board game, first of all, everyone loves conspiracy theories. Like, don't even come at me with that, like, oh, I don't believe in it, blah, blah, blah. Like, they're still fun. And so Neddy Games, spelled N-E-D-D-Y, has this amazing Trivial Pursuit board game based around conspiracy theories. And if you're like me and you love drinking and playing games with your friends, I highly recommend it.
And if you follow the link in the show note today, you'll get a 10% discount off your very own coffee. Thank you for listening to this episode of Creepy Unsolved. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more like it, please leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you are listening from. This will help our podcast grow. Also, be sure to subscribe, follow, and share the podcast. If you have an interesting story or would like to be a guest on a future episode of Creepy Unsolved, please reach out to us through Instagram or Facebook at Creepy Unsolved, or send us an email at creepyunsolvedmedia@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you soon.